This is April 19th, 2009, and today I'm going to read from an article about mindfulness and comment on it. This article appeared last month in the New York Times. It's by Judith Warner, who's a blogger for the New York Times. It's under her area of blogging is, she calls, domestic disturbances. So she comments on a variety of different topics. And this one, March 5th of this year, she writes about being and mindfulness. That's the title of her blog for that day. And there's a lot in here that I think could use commenting on. So she begins, "The other night at a dinner party, a friend described how she tried to practice mindfulness meditation to keep herself from losing it during an utterly wretched 7-hour layover in an airport while she was exhausted, ill, and desperate to get home to her children. She said, I kept trying to be here now. But I just wanted to be anywhere but here." We all laughed. Then she described how on another day she'd managed not to bite off the head of a woman who'd been gratuitously mean to her 8-year-old daughter. But instead she had stayed in the moment, that's in italics, and had connected and been able to join with the woman in an experience of their common, sadly limited humanity. At which point, full of congratulations and suppressing my own story of having lost my temper with a woman in an airport bathroom who, I felt, had addressed my daughter Julia with an unforgivable tone of officiousness and disdain. So, at which point, full of congratulations, I was beginning to wonder what body snatcher had taken my cranky friend away and left this kindly, calm pod person in her place. Where was the woman I always seek out at school events to laugh with? Where was the black humor, the sense of absurdity? I felt strangely abandoned. If there's ever a place where it's intelligent to practice mindfulness, it's in such circumstances, stressful circumstances of being caught in an airport. What's the alternative? That's the first question I would ask. As we hear, as the article goes along, she wonders at this... You know, trying to be serene and detached and accepting of circumstances out of your control. What's the alternative to that? It's being miserable. So we see here, when she says, the author says, I was beginning to wonder what body snatcher had taken my cranky friend away and left this kindly, calm pod person in her place. Now, this is one of the challenges one faces when beginning a meditation practice is the resistance on the part of some friends and family members, the resistance to your changing. They have gotten used to you as they know you, and even though that you may be annoying and difficult to get along with at times, to see a new you to your friend or family member can be disorienting and mildly anxiety-provoking, because we are so invested in this notion of a permanent, substantial self, one's own self and that of others, that when that metamorphosis starts to happen, one can find oneself reacting to it and wishing it were otherwise. I remember after I'd been sitting for a while, I don't know, 6 months or something, and I visited my parents and my family, and my mother, watching me very sharply, said, "You're so quiet." It made me realize that earlier, and I had been something of a show-off at our family dinners, our family meals, and actually there's a lot of showing off by all of us, trying to, you know, the kind of jockeying for our parents' attention and the attention of other people, and I had started to slough that off and just been more listening, and it left my mother distressed a little bit. She wondered what happened to her son. Who was this? Who are you, and what have you done with my son? So people, this is one of the most frightening things about being human is change. When you get right down to it, when you look at all the circumstances that cause us distress, that leave us anxious, an awful lot of it just comes down to change. So that's the first problem that we may have to face with people close to us, and when we start changing, is their resistance to us changing. Where was the woman I always seek out at school events to laugh with? Where was the black humor, the sense of absurdity? There's absolutely nothing about meditation practice that would drain you of a sense of humor. It's a question of what is the object of the humor? What are you laughing about, or whom are you laughing at? That's where... laughing at people, at other people, as a way of disparaging them, of feeling superior oneself. This is something I think that we gradually lose as we begin to get more thoroughly into practice. But I would say it's. As far as all other kinds of humor, of laughing at just the many things one can laugh at all the time about life and people, but in a non disparaging, sneering way, this is something that I think that is cultivated. We are freed up to laugh through meditation. You know, throughout my comments this morning, I'll be, even though the article I don't think ever mentions Buddhism or Zen, it's about mindfulness. I mean, that's the title, Being and Mindfulness, and there's a lot of mindfulness. I mean, it's a big, huge component of Zen practice. It's just being mindful, aware, present, basically. So, There's much here that we can consider in terms of Zen practice. I felt strangely abandoned, she said. It was, I realized, my first experience of being on the receiving end of someone sharing their journey on the road to mindfulness. The meditation and life practice that's all the rage now in psychotherapy, women's magazines, even business journals, as a way to stay calm, manage anger, and live sanely. In the past, I'd been only on the other side of the divide. I had, it was true, sensed a certain sadness, even feelings of betrayal, in my husband Max's reaction to my proselytizing about my Pema Chodron Getting Unstuck CD. I never thought that you, of all people, would get into that New Age stuff, he'd said wistfully. But I hadn't realized that when a person gets unstuck, the people around her can feel a bit left behind. That's the other aspect to this, is that if you see someone becoming more serene and open and accepting and quiet, it can make you more aware. It accentuates your own anxiety, tension, and so forth. That's another reason why people won't necessarily welcome your undertaking a sitting practice. It has dawned on me lately, she continues, meditating on the metro, thoughts silenced so completely that I can hear every page being turned by passengers up and down the car. And then she puts in parentheses in italics as to show that this is her thought process. I am above reading. I am present to myself. So again, it has dawned on me lately, meditating on the metro, that being fully in the moment, all senses turned on, feeling your hands in your lap and the ground under your feet, is a very good way of not being there at all. Now, let's talk about this. Most of you don't need to hear this. You know your own experience. I would just slightly edit that to mean it's a very good way of the ego self not being there at all. It is exactly the opposite of her. What is obvious for her is obviously a new experience, meditation, and she's just starting to. She hasn't really gotten her footing yet in this new world of meditation, but there is no question, but that if you are free of thoughts relatively. If your mind is unclogged with reverie, with daydreams, that you will be more fully aware. Duh, of course. And what she seems to be trying to work her way through is this new world where the kibitzing mind, the mind of self-consciousness, is not there. Suddenly, at this moment, a memory of an image seen from The Seventh Samurai is coming to my mind, where it shows the band of samurai who are fighting the evil band of bandits, and one of the samurai, they're waiting, they're going to lie in ambush for the bad guys, and this one samurai races to a little hiding place on a slope in the weeds or the bushes, and he just sits down suddenly, and he almost appears to be going to sleep. It's clear otherwise from what follows, but he's sitting there, his head is almost slumped down a little bit, eyes half closed. It's not, you can't see it that clearly, but he just goes into this quiescent state where he's not doing anything. He's just waiting. And surely the point is that he's in a state of complete presence. And this is the ideal state, or we could say no state. It's a sort of the absence of being in any state. It's just being fully present. This is the ideal presence to have in the martial arts. This is why so many karate, aikido, taekwondo, and other martial arts, why so many of teachers want their students to practice Zen and other kinds of meditation, because it makes you fully present and able to respond no-mindedly in the way, whatever is called for, in whatever way is best. So this is just a complete misunderstanding of what being there means. She says it's a very good way of not being there at all. Yeah, okay, let's go with that. With that construction of that phrase, not being there, of not getting in the way of what is, not getting in the way of this moment here, fully alive, aware. Saint Exupéry once said, in anything at all, perfection is finally attained not when there is no longer anything to add, but when there is no longer anything to take away, when a body has been stripped down to its nakedness. This is what Zen does, and presumably what this other kind of mindfulness meditation does. Is it strips us down to what is most essential in us. It in other words, it takes away what is false, what is not us. It frees us from these what William Blake called these mind-forged manacles that keep us bound to our habitual reactions and our suffering. And then she goes on. For me, this is a big part of the charm of the whole thing. I mean, it's a lot easier to feel a loving connection to others, to the madding crowd, that is, when you're entirely checked out. But it's not supposed to be that way. So this whole piece is just laced with misunderstandings and false notions about all kinds of things. It's not supposed to be that way. What does it matter what it's supposed to be, much less her notion of what it's supposed to be? We don't care what it's supposed to be, anyone. We don't care what a teacher, a Zen teacher, says it's supposed to be. It's what is. What we want to become attuned to is what is now, what is happening right now. Checked out. See, she can use these vague kinds of slang terms and not have to be accountable for them because they're vague. But to go on, mindfulness is supposed to bring people together by embracing your essential humanness, getting in touch with and accepting your body, sensations, emotions, and thoughts. You are supposed to join with and empathetically connect to all humanity. Yes, and that's what happens. Eventually, if you do this long enough, you do connect, because it's our thoughts, it's this din this noise in the mind from the time we wake up in the morning until we fall asleep at night, it's that which divides us. That which sustains the illusion of fragmentation, of separateness. When that mind falls silent, then the truth is revealed, that we are all this one mind. We are all connected in the most basic, the most fundamental way. And then she quotes a psychologist, Mary Pfeiffer. "It helps to realize we are not alone." She writes in her new book, Seeking Peace, Chronicles of the Worst Buddhist in the World, which the author says is an account of how mindfulness meditation helped her recover from the depression and self-depletion that followed the surprise success of her huge 1994 hit, Reviving Ophelia, and subsequent bestsellers. And then again, she quotes, the author quotes this Mary Pfeiffer. "One thing I like to do is send my silent good wishes to people all over the world who have problems exactly like my own. Contexts may change, but emotions are universal." Okay, this is someone who is testifying to how much mindfulness meditation changed her life for the better. But then the author comments, "I have no doubt that this meta-connectedness feels real and indeed is real, in the abstract at least." Okay. Hold on. Hold everything. It's either real or it's abstract. You can't have it both ways. Again, the cleverness with which one can misuse words there's what is real, this, the concrete, the direct experience of things, sensations, immediate perceptions, that is in Zen is what we call real, as much as anything is real. But abstraction is something else. She says, "But in real life encounters, I've come lately to wonder whether meaningful bonds are well forged by the extreme solipsism that mindfulness practice often turns out to be." I meant to look up solipsism for the fifth time in my life. Who can help me with that? Solipsism.
Only I exist.
Self-referential.
And the ego's all there is.
Yeah. Okay. I did learn egregious a long time ago. All right, the extreme self-referentialism that mindfulness practice often turns out to be. Well, for her, mainly, maybe. Now we're getting into the real gist of this article. But I'll read more for her to develop that more. "For one thing, there's the seemingly unavoidable problem that people who are embarked on this particular journey of self-exploration, as Pfeiffer has called it, those people tend to want to talk or write about it a lot. But what they don't realize, because they're so in the moment, caught in the wonder and fascination and totality of their self-experience, is that their stories are like dream sequences in movies, or college students' journal entries, or the excited accounts your children bring you of absolutely hilarious moments in cartoons. You really do have to be the one who's been there to tolerate it. Yeah, I think, you know, this is, there's a lot to this point she's making, and this is the problem I've always had with writing, is when you have to sit down and write about the experience, it's so diminished. It's so thin and tasteless compared to the experience itself. I mean, I would go so far as to say it is a real sacrifice to, for example, to have to write about Zen. Because in writing about it, you just get farther and farther from the experience itself. She goes on, "For the truth is, however admirable mindfulness may be, however much peace, grounding, stability, and self-acceptance it can bring, as an experience to be shared, it's stultifying boring." She may be right. Reading about other people's experiences and success with mindfulness, it's the other person's experience. I don't know, though. I mean, reading, for example, the Enlightenment accounts in the Three Pillars of Zen, this, you know, changed my life. It's the most galvanizing thing. But I guess, you know, reading about mindfulness experiences is different. It's maybe to some people boring because it's so simple, and our minds are so complicated that we've become kind of addicted to being entertained and being juiced up on different kinds of dramas in our minds, that to hear something just laid out in its simplicity can be boring, I guess, to some people. Yeah, so great. If you're bored about reading about it, then do it. And you won't be bored if you really do it well. In fact, boredom is a sign that you're not doing it right. Boredom is a great signal that the body-mind gives us that we're not engaged enough with the experience at hand. It's a signal that there is some mediation of thought or conceptualization that's coming between us and the direct experience. It's reducing the pure direct experience. That's what boredom always means. People who have gotten far enough into sitting to have experienced the kind of fascination or the wonderful experiences you can have simply facing a wall. What could be more boring on the face of it than facing a wall? And yet, we know, those of us who have done this for more than a short while, we know that even in just facing the wall, we can have wonderful experiences sweep over us. So the boredom is not in the activity itself or the sitting itself. It's in how we're using or misusing the mind. But yeah, hearing about when I was walking down the street, I was just walking. It was wonderful. And then she continues, I've also come to wonder if something desirably human is being lost in all this new and improved selfhood. That is to say, an edge. That little bit of raggedness that for some of us is really the heart of what makes us human. Shave that piece off, soften it too mindfully, and I wonder if we don't leave others out in the cold. I saw this clearly the other day in a chance email exchange with my friend D. She had written me to share some anxieties about the recession. They were very real and very pressing, and in the past I would have responded with very pertinent examples of how things were much worse for me. This is what women do. They join with when someone is describing, is self-disclosing about anxiety or sorrow or whatever, women are much better at joining with them in offering their own similar experience. It's a wonderful thing. This time, however, tapping into great human reserves of calm and centeredness, I tried instead to lead her into staying with her feelings. Hang in there. Things will be okay, I wrote. D, my oldest friend, has not in the past been shy about implying that there's something inward-looking and self-indulgent about my professed attempts at being present in the world. Now she wrote back in outrage. What did you do with the real Judy? Did you just tell me to hang in there? Things will be okay? 4 question marks. She says, the author says, I screamed back. It is comforting to me when people say things like that. It is comforting to me when people say things like that. Sorry, I screamed back. There, is that okay? And it was okay. The connection, 43 years of happy shouting, was restored. Okay. It does strike me as a little bit too removed for this author to have written back to her friend, "Hang in there, things will be okay." I mean, that's good advice. There isn't much better advice than hanging in there, waiting for things to change. Things always do change. Things always pass. But as a two-sentence email response, after you're getting this genuine outpouring of concern about the recession and where it's leading, this falls short of what I would call skillful means, a skillful empathic response. Maybe as a final reminder that yes, things somehow will all work out and hang in there. Sure, who can fault that as advice? But first to let her friend know that she hears her, that she somehow feels as empathy and sympathy for her situation, would have been a more sensible, helpful response probably for most people. But the larger issue here is about her, where she says earlier, I wonder if something desirably human is being lost in all this new and improved selfhood. That is to say, an edge, that little bit of raggedness that for some of us is really the heart of what makes us human. Well, those of us who've been sitting a long time find that we still have raggedness aplenty. But because we're more aware of it, it doesn't get the upper hand as often. It doesn't get the better of us. we can work with it. We can manage the raggedness, meaning the rough edges, the sharp corners that remain until, I suppose, full enlightenment. Yes, this is part of being human. There's no question about it. But our mission here is not to try to meet some pre-formulated notion of humanity. It's to stop causing harm to ourselves and others. That's what this all comes down to. The Buddha famously said, "I teach but two things, suffering and the end of suffering." And if raggedness means our egoistic tendencies, our displays of anger, resentment, or greediness, confusion, what we call in Buddhism the three poisons, greed, hostility, and delusion. If that's what it means, then it's simply masochistic it's so foolish to think about wanting to preserve those things. I think it comes from ignorance of what meditation will bring. Meditation does not strip us of our unique personality. On the contrary, it liberates this innate character that we have that is different from everyone else. Mindfulness does not fashion us into a bland, unfeeling automaton. It strips us, again, it strips us of that which gets in the way of our authenticity as human beings. I think the biggest misunderstanding in here is the implication that if we do this practice, that we become false somehow. Well, we become false by being self-conscious about doing the practice. And I think this is very common early in practice, where in practice we want so much to change. Who doesn't want to change? We want to change. We want to be more than we have been up to then. That is to be more authentically what we know is possible, what we believe is possible in us. And because we want so much to change, and we want others to see us as changed, then there can be a certain artificiality about the way we conduct ourselves early in practice. Who hasn't experienced? Who can't remember doing, acting, or saying foolish things when you first get into this practice? So we have so little when we start this practice. We have so little real experience at it that all we have to go on, mostly what we have to go on, is our notions about what it means to be a mindful person, or a Zen person, or an enlightened person. These are just notions in the mind, and that's where we get into trouble, because we put on a pose of someone who is present, someone who is mindful, someone who is aware, someone who is selfless, without an ego. Well, that doesn't work. If we still have a very ego-centered perspective in our relationships and all, it doesn't work to pretend otherwise. I don't mean that we have to indulge our egoistic reactions, our anger and jealousies and everything. That's different. But mindful does not mean inauthentic. It means to be real. What mindfulness, what Zen meditation brings, is is not a certain persona that we think is desirable, but it frees us enough to be real, to be authentic, to be in, when we get in touch with our feelings, our reactions, then we become more real, which is not the same as just acting out every feeling that comes through us. This is a hugely important distinction. There's the feeling, being aware of the feeling, and then there's acting on it, which is something entirely different. When we become fully aware of what's going on in our mind and our body, that is, when we really become attuned to these cross currents of feelings and emotions and bodily reactions that occur all the time during the day, when we're really aware, attuned to that, then we find often that we don't need to lash out at someone. We don't need to play out our sorrow and do a whole operatic, kind of dramatic, reactive thing in our lives. So the problem is not mindfulness. Certainly, not just an outsider's perspective, but a really misunderstanding outsider. The problem is not mindfulness per se, but trying to display it. And that's where I can join with her and her friend about how obnoxious that can be if you're trying to display your mindfulness. What is that? That's just foolish. So, we have these terms in Zen, true self, no self, and just plain ego self. In the course of meditation practice over months and years, again, we shed what is truly us. That stuff is sort of based on or composed of notions, images. And as we shed that stuff, then we become more authentically who we are than we ever have been. And it's a wonderful feeling of finding that congruence between how we present on the outside and who we really are on the inside. They become more and more conjoined, and that means authenticity. There was one response to this blog, this article, that caught my eye, where the respondent says, "I find that the people I know who are Xinjianged with meditation," never heard that word, Xinjianged with meditation, meaning cooled out, says, "are anything but boring. They are anything but pod people. They are funny, edgy, quick, connected, bright, and all kinds of other good stuff. Just keep sitting, Judith. You'll see." and you do see this with people who have been doing this a long time. There is such a natural, responsive humanity to them. And if it's not there, if you feel that something is repressed, if you sense in someone that something's repressed or bound up in them, well, it just means that however much sitting they've done, they need to do more of it or better quality of sitting. Because ultimately, it's all about liberating our true self. When we get free of our notions about ourselves, that is, our self-consciousness, when we get free of that, then we become fully ourselves. We said it in the Hakuin chant, when we recited this morning before Teisho, our true self is no self, our own self is no self. No self just means no self-consciousness. There is a very short koan in the Blue Cliff record collection where a monk by the name of Echo goes to a Zen master, I forget who, and he says, my name is Echo, now please tell me, what is Buddha? This was a common way to open a dialogue with a master in ancient China. What is Buddha? What is our Buddha nature, our true self, the original mind, our original self? And the master simply replied, "You are Echo. You are Echo." I ran across a Yiddish saying once that goes like this: if I try to be like him, who will be like me? One of the most often quoted statements in the teachings of the great Japanese Zen master Dogen is the following statement: to learn the Buddhist way is to learn about oneself. To learn about oneself is to forget oneself. To forget oneself is to perceive oneself as all things. To realize this is to cast off the body and mind of self and others. In other words, all notions of separation, all notions of oneself and all notions of others, and just experience them one directly, respond naturally. When you've reached this stage, you will be detached even from enlightenment, but will practice it continually without thinking about it. But this, the gist of this is to learn about oneself is to forget oneself. Learn is not the best translation. Zen practice, again, is the opposite. It's unlearning. Unlearning all of the stuff we have picked up in our minds about who we are. Letting go of the thoughts. We never have to worry about what's going to happen to who we really are, this true self. It's letting go of the thoughts that get in the way of our being fully authentic. Satchel Paige, the old pitcher, great baseball pitcher, said, "Don't be sharp or flat, just be natural." This image floated up while I was sitting this morning of the infinite variety of living things, flowers, plants, snowflakes, individuals, human beings, creatures of every kind. Everything is unique. Every single thing is unique. There's no two snowflakes alike. There are no two human beings alike. What makes the problem is this dust of thoughts that comes over us that creates the illusion of a non uniqueness of things. I had this memory bubble up of when I was still living in Michigan. We lived to get to our house. You had to go over dirt road, and in the summer the dust would cloud as the cars went by. I would often walk along this dirt road, and you'd see the roadside flowers and plants of every kind, the wildflowers, the trillium, the May apples, and all kinds of different things. They all get covered with this dust from the road. And then after a rain, it would all be washed off, and you'd see every single thing in its bright uniqueness. This is the rain. The rain of our practice is cleansing, scouring, washing the mind of the self-consciousness that obstructs our natural, free functioning and our individuality that comes from that. This, to finish up here, she says, some of us experience our emotions always in capital letters and exclamation points. This isn't always pleasant, but to go all mindful for a moment, it is what it is. And if you are one of these people, then probably one of the great pleasures of your life is finding others like you and settling in with them for a good rant. A world devoid of such souls can be cold and forbidding, and above all, this is the ultimate sin, terribly, terribly dull. Yeah, it would be. Of course it would if we were all the same. If there weren't people of all different kinds. And that's one of the great treasures of this, the third of the three treasures, the Sangha, is there is such diversity and different types of people, personalities and ethnic groups and races and learning to appreciate each person as she is and as he is without any notions of trying to fit them into how we're supposed to be as Zen Buddhists or anything else. Finally, she says, it is selfish, undoubtedly, to want to hold on to the ragged edges that make me feel genuinely connected. Not perhaps to humanity, but to the people I love. But then the fact is, I can probably beat Mary Pfeiffer hands down at being the worst Buddhist in the world. Truth is, this is her last sentence, truth is, I just don't want to let go. If she would find, if she were able to let go, again, that means let go of her notions, if she were able to let go, then she would be as free and authentic and human and still having plenty of ragged edges. If those are so precious to her, her ragged edges, she needn't fear. There's plenty of those to go around. And all is fine. Let's stop now and recite the four Bodhisattva vows.